feels really short. All right. Hi, my name is Rowan, and I am an alcoholic. I've been nervous all day. And there was a time in my sobriety where my ego would never allow me to be nervous, but the longer I stay sober, the more I realize how little I know. So it's been a couple of years since I've shared my story, and I don't like to plan it. I like to just kind of hand it over and just see whatever comes out. So it could be a hot mess, people. First of all, I want to say thank you for asking me to speak. It is an honor, even though I'm a nervous wreck. I know that this is what keeps me sober, and I know it's what I have to do for the rest of my life. I have to stay doing this sort of stuff and getting uncomfortable, and I committed to doing that very, very early in sobriety. It was actually around step six that I committed that, but I'll talk about that later. My sobriety date is June 6th, 2007, so I just celebrated 10 years of this stuff. Yeah. I remember having a couple of weeks. I remember having 24 hours. Actually, no, I don't remember having 24 hours because the first 90 days were quite blurry, but I remember being in early sobriety and looking at people with 10 years, and just, it was the most unattainable thing I'd ever seen. I was just, maybe for you guys, but not for this alcoholic. And I really believed that. I really believed that there was just no way I would make it to 10 years, and here I am. A little bit about me. I grew up, you might notice a little tiny bit of an accent. It's faded a lot over the years. I was born in Dublin, Ireland, on Easter Sunday, 1971. And I know you're doing the math, some of you, so that makes me 22. As they say at home, I'm 22 and a bit, and the bit's my own business. So I'm 46. Grew up in Dublin. In dirty Dublin, and was really like a scruffy street kid. And I was born into, you know, I know like most Americans think of leprechauns and rolling hills and the soap that you guys use, that shit. That does not exist where I come from. The first bowl of Lucky Charms I was offered, I was like, what is this shit? You know? What is that? But, also doesn't exist in Ireland. So you guys are being conned, is all I'm going to say on that. But, you know, people think of Ireland as that, but there is also a lot of sorrow. And, you know, I don't end up in Alcoholics Anonymous because I came from a beautiful childhood. I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous because I came from... I was born to a depressed mother who was addicted to Valium, and she would take Valium and then go to her room and stay there forever, is what it felt like as a little girl. And my dad was an untreated, or is an untreated, bipolar, paranoid, schizophrenic pedophile, unfortunately. And so I was born into that house. And really, really young, I knew, like, I was in a crazy house. Like, I wasn't sitting there confused. I was like, these people are nuts. And I remember looking for, like, adoption papers, like, when I was little. I was like, I cannot belong to these people. It's just not, I just couldn't comprehend it. And I would literally search through all their stuff and look for these adoption papers. Because, you know, when you come from abuse, there was forms of escapism that I used. And one of my escape routes was I would bring my, my bags, school bag, and all my clothes onto my bed every single night. And every single night, I would pretend that it was a boat I was in and I was sailing away. And that was one of my escapisms. And one of the other ones was to keep searching for these real parents that exist. They're like on television in Little House on the Prairie and stuff. And I grew up with like the Brady Bunch and all that American television. So I was convinced that I really belonged to a family like that, and that I would find paperwork and I'd be able to escape. But that wasn't the case. I looked like my dad. My personality is actually a lot like him. And I always think to myself, for a long time, I hated that fact. I was really ashamed. Like, when I was little, people would be like, you're just like your father. And the horror of being like this man that behind closed doors, you know, was hell. But now, today, having worked these glorious things right here, I love the fact that I'm like him. He's super intelligent, and he's funny, and he's sick, and I am no longer, you know, sick. And so I get to be the good of what he could have been. So growing up, you would think that being in a mentally ill, untreated mental illness household, that would be what screwed me up. But being raised Mormon in Dublin, Ireland, man, oh man. My parents were baptized in the Irish Sea, right, because there was no church, because the Mormon church is quite new. I don't know how old it is, but it's quite new compared to Catholicism and the Protestants that were killing each other. But my parents converted when I was 1.5, and they got baptized in the Irish Sea. So we grew up Mormons in Dublin, and that was just crazy. Like, because I would have to go to these special schools, and everybody would call us morons instead of Mormons, because nobody in Ireland knew what it was. And we were linked with the Moonies and all the weird, obscure religions. And it was just very peculiar. And my family was very dedicated to it. My dad especially was super dedicated. He, in his delusions, thought he was a prophet of God. So I got to grow up with the prophet of the one true church on the earth. And there's no trauma there from that at all. You know, he would bless the food for like a half an hour. I just want to eat it, you know. But and he would come down the stairs, and he would have these visions, and we always had to move. I think I lived in, like, as an alcoholic, I tend to exaggerate, so give me one moment. I think I lived in about 12 houses by the time I was 12. And because we just had to keep moving, because they were coming to get us, and no one can be trusted. And the whole world is out to get you. And that's really how I was raised. My whole life I was programmed that no one was to be trusted. And it's also, I mean, I know it's in a lot of different cultures, but it's very much in the Irish culture that you don't take your shit outside the family. And you don't trust anyone, and you sweep it under the rug, and it stays there. And so I never spoke about what was going on. I never talked about the sexual abuse or the physical abuse or the emotional abuse. I just got on with life, and that was kind of like what I knew. But I did know that it was not how it was supposed to be. And I always knew, my mind always stayed strong. I knew that he would never get to me. He would never break me. I used to climb into the closet. Well, he used to lock us in the cupboards. And when I was in the cupboard, I would... I remember talking to whatever was out there. And it was my brother who had passed away, is what I was thinking in my mind when I was a little girl. And I remember just thinking and saying out loud that I know I'm being watched over. And I know that I won't die in any of this situation. I know that I'll be okay. And I always knew it. I was crying. I was scared. But deep down, fundamentally, I knew that I was stronger than this, bigger than this, and that there was more for me in life than this. And I don't know how I knew it, but I knew it. And it drove him crazy. It drove him nuts that I would just stare him right in the eyes and just have no real fear of what, you know, as a man who was supposed to be watching over me, I would look at him like, you know, shame on you kind of thing from the earliest age, and it drove him nuts, tormented him. And And as a result, I kind of got the brunt of the stick, but that's okay. My mother, I don't know if you guys know, but there is no divorce in Ireland until 1997. It was against the law. So I had a lot of resentments against my mother, and we hashed it out in my sobriety. For a long time, we hashed it out. And God bless her, she stood there in front of me, and she took it. And I had a lot of, I had a lot to say. As far as I was concerned, there was a way out, even when there was no way out. But she was amazing in the end, and I also lost her just about a year ago. She was amazing. She tracked me down and stood in front of me. I think she stayed for about 3 months until I would speak to her and basically just said, I'm not leaving until, you know, you accept my apology. And I did, thanks to these steps, thanks to this program. No divorce. So they stayed miserably married for 30 years, and it was a shotgun wedding. You know, and in Ireland, if you get up the pole, she told me that her dad was like, you will marry him. They didn't care if he was crazy. It just doesn't matter. You will get married. And so he paid. My grandfather was very rich and paid for the wedding. And it was like, my mother said it was like 2 days into the wedding or into the marriage that she saw the crazy. And, you know, I don't know what she felt at that point, at 25 or whatever age she was, but for her there was no way out. And anytime she wanted to leave, in any of the arguments or whatever, you know, the usual threat of killing all of us and blah, 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 and she would have had to have gone to England, so on and so forth. So needless to say, they stayed married. And at 21, I had a watershed moment. It was one of the very, I've had a few of them in my life, but my dad decided that he was going to apply for a Morrison visa to get into America because Americans were better than the Irish people. And so he applied for the green card for the whole family. Actually, I was 20. And the son of a bitch got it, and it was a lottery system. And so I remember rolling my eyes thinking, you crazy lunatic, we're not going to get the green card to go to America. But somehow or another, this, you know, big brown envelope arrived at the door, and he had done it. And I remember thinking, finally I get rid of him out of this country, you know, he's going to go. And I went on upstairs, and I was doing my own thing. And I was delighted that my whole family was going to be leaving. And I knew just suddenly that if I didn't take this opportunity, that absolutely nothing in my life would change. I just knew without a doubt. And I didn't want to come here. I didn't want to change anything. I just wanted to stay, whatever that was. And I was very broken. But I decided to come over to the States when I was 20, and I arrived here in 1992 when I was two. And I am dyslexic, you know, so my own math. But I arrived over here, and it was all children under 21, so I had 10 days to say goodbye to everybody and to get into this country. And so I did. I just packed up everything into a couple of suitcases, and I moved to the States and turned 21. I emigrated here. I was looking because I'm applying for citizenship right now. I emigrated on the 7th of April, and I turned 21 on the 11th of April. So I just slid right in there. And I had $1,500 to my name. And what's interesting is, though, I know you're waiting for alcoholism here. It doesn't exist until much later on in my life. I was raised Mormon. We don't drink. So I didn't experience alcoholism in my family or around me. I had an uncle who was an alcoholic, but that was about it. I got here. I didn't drink. I was a really good Mormon girl. And I, you know, good Irish Mormon girls emigrate to Salt Lake City, Utah. That's what you do. So that's what I did. And I showed up in Salt Lake. And boy, was that a trip. You know, I felt like I'd come from like the gangs of Ireland or you know, Gangs of New York type thing, and here I am in Salt Lake, and I cannot describe the culture shock I went into. And I had left all my family, so I came on my own. And I had $1,500. I remember on my 21st birthday, I thought the best thing I could buy myself was a hairdryer. I mean, I am so tomboy, and I remember looking at the hairdryer after I bought it and thought, I don't know why I bought you, but the next thing that I bought was a 1979 Ford Thunderbird, because I thought it looked cool. Yeah, right? $500 that cost me. Now I'm down to like $970-something dollars. I should have returned a hairdryer. So I'm driving around Salt Lake City in this gangbanger car, and every time I pull up to the stoplight, like all the other gangbangers are like, and then they see this little white Irish girl looking at them. It was, oh my gosh. But I taught myself how to drive, because I didn't drive in Ireland. I mean, I drove a tractor here and there, because at one point Daddy had us living out in the countryside with the cows and the rolling hills and the leprechauns. So I drove tractors, but I'd never driven a real car. So I hopped into the Ford Thunderbird and I taught myself. But I wasn't sure what OR meant or the D. I knew. I was very crystal clear on what OR meant when I took out the mailbox right behind me in the complex. I knew then what the OR, it meant reverse, in case you don't know. Which meant that D probably meant drive, and I was good to go. And I went, studied for the test, and got passed the test, aced the test. I was super proud of myself, never did a class. But my driving to this day is mad as a hatter. I mean, people cling to the side of the car when I'm driving. Self-made, but... So it was a huge culture shock, and I got... You know, I lasted about a year, and I taught America... Again, I'd come from so much neglect and abuse that... I just found Americans too nice, and I just couldn't deal with it. And I left and went back home, and I went back home, and after a year of being in America, I found Irish too brash. I was like, oh, my God, you guys are rude. The Americans are really nice. They've been tender with me for the whole year, and now you guys are mocking me because I have an American accent. So, you know, I went back and forth from Ireland to America, I think, 2 or 3 times. At one point, I went home for a three-week holiday and came back 3 years, and that was before 9/11. So you could actually do something like that. Now they know everything about everything. But before then, they would look at the monitor, because you're not supposed to leave for more than 6 months on a green card. So I had left for 3 years. Oops, now I got to get back in, because I decided America was for me again. They're standing there looking at the monitor. I'll never forget it in JFK. And he's like, how long have you been out of the country? And I'm like, 3 weeks. And he looks at the monitor pretending he's seeing something. And he's like, well, welcome home. And I'm like, oh, thank God. You know, I had no return ticket. The ticket, I told him I'd lost. I mean, it was just ridiculous, the lies I had to tell. But I got back in. And... what's interesting is that I was 335 pounds, and this is where my story varies a little for people who are in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 335 pounds, and I ate instead of drank. And I decided I had gotten this swanky job in Dublin. I was, you know, talked my way into every job, but my brokenness stayed with me, and I would find these great jobs, and I would sit in them, and I would not know how to do them, and I had no self-esteem. And I was 335 pounds, and I was sitting there, and it was the next watershed moment in my life. And I thought to myself, if I don't go back to America and do something about this weight, my life will never change. And I knew I was eating. I was textbook abuse, you know, went into the refrigerator at 10 and never left. And I flew back into the States, got through JFK, telling them I had been there for 3 weeks, and I had... the gastric bypass surgery, probably about 3 months later. I went back to an old company, and they had great insurance, so I got the gastric bypass when it was super uncool for like $500. And I lost, I want to say 130 pounds in 9 months. And back then, they didn't, now they make you go to a therapist and this and that and the other. But back then, it was just like, you know, we're going to cut you open. You're going to eat the size of an egg. That's it. And I started drinking alcoholically 2 weeks after I had the surgery. I had also discovered that I wasn't a good Mormon girl and that I really was a lesbian. And so I had come out and I had gastric bypass surgery, like, all in the same week. And so I was just, I had arrived. I'm going to be this skinny bitch that. So I hit, and I was back in Salt Lake. And I don't know if you guys know, but, you know, it's full of gay people. It's like they're all trapped in Salt Lake City. But I found the bar scene, and I'd never done any of this. And I just shed myself of all Mormonism and took off the funny underwear and put the Salt Lake Temple behind me, and off I went. And I went into the bar scene, and I was losing all this weight, and I was having a grand old time. And when you have the gastric, you can drink 5 drinks, be absolutely wasted, eat 7 peanuts, sober up. It's miraculous. It is literally miraculous. It's like the clouds have opened. I know people would tell me they take Coke to go on lunch. No, I didn't need this. 7 peanuts, sober as a judge, and then like a half an hour later, I'd drink again. And I did not realize that it is equivalent to you normal people with normal stomachs drinking. That's 2 nights in a row of drinking in one night. And so I would do that 4 or 5 times in one evening. I'd drive people over to the next party, and, you know, then I'd drink more, and I'd eat my peanuts, and then, you know, and I, so on and so forth. So I've drank 7 days in a row in one evening, apparently, but I didn't know that. So within 6 months, I was a full-blown alcoholic, like unemployed. Well, I had still had the job, but I remember walking along the wall to hold myself up while I got to the time clock. And I knew my days were numbered in the company. I'd gone from number one, kind of like nationwide, to people just shaking their head when I would come in. And I'm sure you can all relate to that, right? It's just so humiliating. And I would go, I mean, I just couldn't stop drinking. It was just instantaneous. I was, you know, I'd gotten into my very first relationship, and I barely remember any of it. Like, barely remember the person. I see her on Facebook now. I remember some good times, but I barely remember the entire relationship. And I just kind of took people hostage. I didn't know any other way. I didn't know how to love people, and I didn't know how to stop drinking. And that was just who I had become. And it was just so overnight. And I really believed I was going to be something special. And to just sit there with my whiskey in hand and vodka and wine and whatever, I did all that big book stuff where you know, you try the different drinks. You have to. I was like, I'm gonna try vodka because it has less of an odor. And then no one will know that I'm drinking all night long and then going to work. And I, you know, we're crazy. We convince ourselves that that is working. It's oozing out of every single pore in my body, but nobody is smelling it. And my speech is slightly slurred on all of my calls, but, you know, it's no big deal. And my shakes are out of control, and I just keep telling everybody I have terrible blood sugar problems. But inside, I was just so miserable, and I really believed that having that surgery would make everything better. And my whole childhood would be wiped away, and I would be healed, and I would be just, I'd be okay. And my whole life, I had felt like I had arrived in the wrong family at birth. Then we removed the family, and I'm in the wrong country now. And then you remove that country, and I'm in the wrong country again, which is my own country. It just didn't matter, and it took me so long to realize that, you know, I was the common denominator in all the scenarios, and I wasn't long into my addiction when I wanted to no longer be on this planet. It just wasn't long, and I really, really wished that I wouldn't wake up every morning. And I know that you guys in this room know that incomprehensible demoralization that we feel and the loneliness. I just have no words for it. And I never want to forget that. I never, ever want to forget it. I want to stand up here or wherever, if I have that ability to stand up and still say my story at 50, 60 years sober, and I still want to remember that feeling of just having nowhere to go and no solution and no answers and nobody anymore. I went into treatment in Florida. They flew me from Salt Lake to Florida to get sober. And I went into treatment, and I was like a rock star. I'd gotten the drink out of me, and the personality had come back. And it was a 28-day program. And, you know, I managed to do a rehab romance. And we were going to get married. And I guess it was going to be on the invitation, you know, met in treatment in Florida. It was not pretty. And, you know, I really thought that would cure me too. You know, I could have recovery and I could have love. And, you know, even though I was to go get a sponsor, I just didn't take it seriously. And I certainly didn't take this program seriously. My father had taught me that the only reason people need 12 steps is because they're idiots and they need guidance because they have weak minds. And I genuinely, that was my belief system. So when they carted me in the white bus to AA meetings, I would literally sit down the back and be like, these people, wowzer, look at these people. And, you know, this is how I thought. I mean, delusions of grandeur out the yin-yang. And I wasn't mean like my dad, but boy, did I get his ego sometimes. And I was, you know, I'm thankful that I'm not an unkind person. I have my flaws, but, you know, the heart of me is really good. I got a lot of my mother, thank God. But I sat in AA for those meetings, and I would not succumb to this program at all. I had taken years to get away from a cult, and I wasn't entering another one. So I would sit in the AA meetings, and I would pretend that I was paying attention, but really I was here having none of it. And so I got out of the treatment center, and I went on drinking, of course, because until you surrender to this disease, it keeps you. I was convinced that I was strong enough to emigrate to the States by myself. I did not need God. I didn't need any of this spiritual shenanigans you guys were talking about, and I wasn't going to have it. It took a lot. It took institutions. It took lots of ER trips and 911 calls and jail. And in fact, that's where I met Winona. I was doing service in the jail out here. But my jail stint was in Florida. But I never want to forget that, you know, when I was drunk, I did not know what was going to happen. I would look out the window some mornings and just hope that my car was there. I drove drunk. In fact, I was convinced that I could drive better when I was drunk. And people would try to hide the keys from me. And I literally was convinced that I was fine and I could drive just fine. And thank God I didn't kill anyone. But that's just one of the many, many blessings. The rehab romance lasted 7 months, and I drained her bank account. I'm not going to lie. I drained her bank account. I drained her child's college fund. I think that's what we spent. I think that's what we drank. She left. The bank account became empty, and she left. And I was sitting in this apartment. I was about 2 weeks away from being homeless. I rang my mother in Ireland every time I would get drunk, or every other time, I don't really remember. But I would ring her and I would berate her in my drunkenness about her being the reason I'm like this. And I had no solution, and I was just utterly shattered. And so I was sitting on the bed one of the days, I tried to stop drinking. Do you ever do this? You pour the vodka down the sink, and then you literally want to go down the sink and suck it back up. Like, what have I done? When I used to eat, it was the muffins. You know, I'd throw them in the trash. 10 minutes later, I'm like, in the trash, muffins out. Well, it was the same with the vodka, you know. I would be, like, down the garbage disposal, if I could, sucking that vodka back out. But I always want, when I would get drunk, tomorrow I'm going to quit. My body was full of alcohol, and I knew that tomorrow was the day I was going to quit. And the next morning, that thought would never even cross my mind. I would be at the liquor store before, you know, before they're even open. And so that one night, I was there, and I finally just, the tears came down my cheeks, and I cried out, whatever's out there, please help me. And I never drank again. And that is my story. And I got up the next morning. I started the detox process, and I went to AA meetings. I sat there and I listened. And in Florida, they're kind of old school. I've never heard the saying here, but they tell you to take the cotton out of your mouth and put it, or out of your ears and put it in your mouth. And I did. And literally, up until you have like 9 months, you just shut up and listen. And I listened. And I got a sponsor. And the thought of working the 12 steps was just murderous. But I was out of options. I was out of options. I had nowhere to turn. My mother had stopped answering the calls in Ireland. She told me that, you know, I'm just waiting for the call. I'm just waiting for the call that you're gone. And she was brokenhearted. And so I had no options. It just had to come to that for me. And to trust another human being with all of the stuff you have to do in the 12 steps, I wasn't sure I'd be able to do it, but I figured I'd just start with that first one. And I knew, I had admitted I was an alcoholic pretty quickly because I'm clever. And I thought, if I admit I'm an alcoholic, then people will leave me the hell alone. You know, they're like, you know, I know I have a drinking problem. Bugger off. And it worked for a long time. But step one was easy for me. You know, when I sat down with the sponsor, I was like, yes, I have a problem. Duh. And so I wasn't one that was haggling about, you know, well, maybe. No, it was messy. But step two and the whole spiritual part was going to be a big pill for me to swallow. So I just kind of faked it a little bit. Until I discovered that I could be an agnostic in recovery and that I could have my own recovery as long as I had something greater than myself. But it's funny, when I worked with a sponsor, I was so full of ego that I warned her that she may fall in love with me and that she should, you know, just keep herself together. I mean, it was terrible. Now, she was gay, but still, oh, my God. I cringe to this day when I think about it. And it's funny, I've had sponsees say the same thing to me, and I'm just like, just do your step work, you know. Wow. And, so I was convinced that if I had her fall in love with me, by warning her she was going to, I wouldn't have to work steps, and we would just eat dinner and drive around and have a grand old time. But no, she was having none of it, thank goodness. And so she, you know, had me on step two and made me write my conception of a higher power. And boy, I took ages doing that. I mean, lots of people spend a long time on the fourth step, but I was convinced I was going to rewrite how a higher power was defined in the world, and I was going to blow her away. And I showed up with my piece of paper. In fact, I read it just a couple of months ago or a month ago, and I'm like, what is this? I mean, but when you have 3 weeks sober, it's profound. So I showed up at her house, and she's like, you know what, let's hop in the car. I'm going to go to the grocery store and bring it with you. And I'm like, this is not what I wanted, a microphone, podium. You know, this is where she falls on the floor, just cannot compose herself. And so we went to Publix, which is Smith's or whatever, Vaughn's, and she was in the bread aisle picking out what bread she wanted. She's like, go ahead and read it. It's fine. Just read it right here. I swear she knew. And I was like, I'm not reading it here. And she's like, no, really, read it. It's fine. And I'm like, She's like, should I get whole wheat? I was like, I'm going to get drunk tonight, and it's going to be your fault. That's what's going to happen on this one. And I, you know, I left there. I was disgusted. I drove home like a maniac, and I couldn't drink. I wanted to drink despite her, and that option was gone. I remember I drove to Walgreens because in Florida, the Walgreens has a liquor store on one side and Walgreens, and they're all Walgreens. And I would literally sit outside and cry my eyes out like I was grieving a girlfriend. Like, love of my life was gone, and I sobbed that I couldn't go in there and get drunk. I just sobbed that it couldn't be my solution anymore. And then I caught myself doing the things that this woman had told me to do. I would say the Serenity Prayer. And I would find myself driving back to the trailer I was staying in, because someone had let me stay in the back of their trailer because I had nowhere. And that's what I would do. And then I would cry myself to sleep, and I would say those weird prayers, and I would fall asleep. And this is how it went on. And I got to step three, and I'd made a decision. I didn't even know what she meant by my will. I was, you know, my brain must have been mush, because I was like, I don't understand. I've been running this show my whole life. I mean, I don't even understand what you mean by I don't run the show. Like, what does that mean? Like, I couldn't comprehend it. And thank God people broke it down for me. I must have looked like a right moron, because I just couldn't get it. And they were like, look, when you're running the show, it's going to feel weird. And you're going to be wanting to do things that are against the grain of comfortability. And you will know when you're doing the right and the wrong. And thank goodness they simplified it like that for me. Because I just wouldn't have gotten it. And that's how I gradually learned to hand my will over. I ran through my step four, and I thought for sure I would kill her after I did my step five, that I would just have to murder her. And that would be what would have to happen. It didn't. I didn't have any spiritual awakening after step five. I didn't feel anything other than a desire to take her life. Nothing. But what's interesting is that step six and seven is where I woke up. Step six, the forgotten steps, six and seven. In fact, Bill W. didn't even have them in the original steps. And he went to his pastor, I think, and the pastor was like, what are these? What's this? You need to put more spirituality into your steps and your program. And he did, and step six and seven were born. And step six and seven is where I felt I could change, that I didn't have to be a product of my childhood, that I didn't have to stay broken forever. And I read step six and seven in the 12 and 12, and I was terrified of changing, but a part of me realized this is that moment where I get to live and be that person I thought I was going to be. And I had thought that it was going to be famous and in the movies and the this and the that. But in that moment, laying in my bed, reading six and seven, I realized that it's just going to be living a simple life. It's going to be getting up every day and doing an inside job of changing who I am. And, you know, I come from a stubborn man, so I'm going to try not be stubborn. I come from defiance, so I'm going to try not to do that. I come from paranoia, so I'm going to try to just trust. And that's what six and seven did for me. And it was a beautiful thing. And at about 9 months, I started to feel good feelings, not just hell. And I had cravings for the first 9 months. I made a list of the persons. I wasn't afraid to be saying sorry. I was ready. I was ready to start saying I'm sorry. I started to realize that that wasn't me. And this was going to be me, this new person. So I made my amends. I try my best every day to continue to take a personal inventory and to say sorry quickly. I took a wee while in AA, and then at about 3 years, I had my heart broken because I didn't know how to do relationships. I was fine with friendships. I was fine with service. I was fine with all the AA members and work and all of that. But put me in love, and oh, my God. Woo! So I had to step away from AA. Well, I didn't step away, but I simultaneously worked the CODA program. And so that helped me with the relationships part. And I've never looked back from that. I love working both of those programs. AA is my number one, though, because I'm an alcoholic before I'm anything else. And if I don't keep the drink out of my hand, then I'm doomed. So, you know, over the years, I've discovered my higher power, and I know that there is something watching over me. I feel that my life has a purpose. I don't feel that it's supposed to be grand anymore. I love that I can turn it over, and I mean, I still try to run the show. There are certainly trigger things that make me want to control things, but it's getting better every year that passes by. That I can just, you know, it's going to be what it's going. If I lose my job in the morning, you know, I'll find a Starbucks job. I've been close to homeless. I've lived in suitcases. I can do it. And so, you know, no matter what life has given me in sobriety, I really just try to remember that I can do recovery with just a shirt on my back. I can do that. And so I don't have to live in fear that I'm going to go broke. So I don't have to control the job, and I don't have to control the relationship. Today I can have a healthy relationship. I can be honest and transparent, and I can say this is what I'm feeling, and I can say this is when I'm fearful, and this is who I am, and this is the damage that was done to me. I spent a lot of years trying to hide that stuff, trying to pretend I was okay. And vulnerability is a powerful thing. I discovered probably about 4 years ago, Brené Brown's video of, you know, the power of vulnerability. And, you know, that was something that stuck with me, and I realized there's a tremendous strength in doing these programs or these steps. There's courage, like courage I've never had before. I thought courage was, you know, just being brave and facing the world, but courage is about going inside and telling another human being what's going on, and getting real and getting honest and staying that way. This program, it's just molding me into the person I always dreamed when I was a little girl. I just dreamed of being even half of this person, where I can wake up in the morning with joy, and sometimes not joy, but still able to live it and still able to face it, and still... The biggest thing of all is that no matter what's going on, I seem to have, thanks to these steps and working with others and working the program and having a sponsor, I seem to have an element that's deep down inside of me that's just grateful. Even when I'm ungrateful, I still have something inside of me that's grateful. And I was telling my sister, who just entered recovery a year and a bit ago, the other day, I was just saying, you know, no matter what, you've got to remember where you came from, where this took us. And as long as I remember that and keep getting up here and getting uncomfortable and getting vulnerable with you guys and talking about the stuff that I didn't really want to talk about, I feel that it benefits others and it helps me to stay sober. I'm really, really grateful. I thank you again for asking me to do this. And I'm thankful for all of you. Thanks.